In breast, lung, and colorectal cancer, adjuvant chemotherapy is standard of care for patients who've had surgery but are at high risk for recurrence. This treatment strategy has not been evaluated in major phase 3 randomized trials in prostate cancer, but the encouraging recent data for the use of docetaxel chemotherapy in metastatic disease has led to a new generation of studies evaluating adjuvant treatment. I met with medical oncologist Dr. Mario Eisenberger, who's had a leadership role in clinical trials evaluating chemotherapy in prostate cancer, and he began our conversation by commenting on a new study evaluating adjuvant docetaxel in men with high-risk disease after radical prostatectomy.
This is a trial for patients with high-risk features following radical prostatectomy, positive seminal vesicles, high Gleason score, positive nodes, disease outside of the gland, positive margins. They are randomized to receive adjuvant Taxotere every 3 weeks for 6 cycles, plus prednisone, just the way it was on TAX-327 compared to a placebo. The endpoint is time to PSA progression.
I thought that was fascinating, and it doesn't stipulate anything about androgen deprivation.
No.
So does it allow it?
No. The pilot study was started in 2002. So what we did is we used a nomogram, Mike Catan's nomogram, that sort of estimates the probability of PSA relapse based on some clinical and pathological features using a nomogram. That nomogram is on the web, by the way. Patients and physicians have access to it. It's a good nomogram. So what we did is we took men with high-risk features and we gave them 6 months of adjuvant Taxotere plus prednisone, no androgen deprivation. And the trial was fascinating. First of all, we finished 6 months ahead of time.
Wow.
We had 77 patients. We showed that it's feasible. You know, we're a little behind compared to breast cancer. We need to...
A little behind. It's just started an adjuvant chemotherapy study, and it's been standard of care since 1979 in breast cancer.
I couldn't believe that I was asked to do that kind of thing. But anyway, it was a lot of fun because we finished it 6 months ahead of time. The trial showed that adjuvant Taxotere is well tolerated.
What was the age spectrum in the pilot study?
Anywhere between late 40s to upper 70s.
And how did the patients in the older end of the spectrum do?
Very well. They were enthusiastic about it. We didn't want to put them on trial, but they did want to go.
What specifically did you see in terms of side effects and toxicity?
We used the weekly Taxotere because we didn't have the TAX-327 data yet. So we saw a lot of eye, nail toxicity, a little bit of alopecia, and fatigue. But out of the 77 patients, 76 completed it. The one man who did not complete it was a construction worker. He was a little tired and was missing work, so he couldn't continue it. But no real significant toxicities. The fascinating thing is when we put it in a mammogram, we found a huge shift.
Really?
Doubling in time to PSA progression.
Of course, you know, it's not randomized. So
it's a very limited type of observation. It was very interesting. And that together with TAX-327 actually served as the impetus to design a big TAX-3501 study.
And the TAX-327, just to clarify, was in metastatic disease.
TAX-327 was a trial that resulted in the FDA approval of Taxotere in homorefractory patients.
Getting back to the way the men tolerated the adjuvant chemotherapy, you mentioned the eyes tearing, excess lacrimation. What was the spectrum of the problem? Did you have to have people who had to be stented, for example?
Yes, I had one man who needed to be stented. And what we did in the very beginning is we had an ophthalmologist, that, particularly Johns Hopkins, and also Vanderbilt, there was someone who did that very aggressively, who actually examined those patients. And I don't know exactly the numbers, but at our place, we had 16 patients. We needed to stent one. We had no irreversible eye findings. We did find the irreversible eye findings on the 327, but not on the adjuvant trial.
And you mentioned the nails. What exactly do you see?
Brittle, breaking nails and discoloration and actually, you know, quite almost like a dead nail in a couple of these patients.
And again, that was reversible when the drug was stopped?
Reversible. It took several months, though, but the new nail grew back and was normal.
I think we're becoming much more sensitive to the issue of fatigue with adjuvant chemotherapy and all kinds of tumors. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the level of fatigue and how long it took the men to recover once they stopped treatment?
Very rapidly. The fatigue with Taxotere is quickly reversible. That is, if you use the every 3-week cycle, before the next administration, most patients already recovered. In general, it lasts about 3 to 4 days. It can be severe, but in general, it's not. And Tax 3 to 7, if I'm not wrong, the incidence of severe grade 3 and 4 fatigue was less than 20%.
What do we know about the mechanism of why people get the fatigue?
I don't know. I think that is a combination of factors. Maybe some hematological parameters, neurological parameters. You know, taxanes are known to produce some neurotoxicity, and I wonder whether that's sort of a spectrum of neurotoxicity that you see with taxanes. And of course, we know that chemotherapy in general is associated with fatigue. Now, men who are androgen deprived, they're particularly susceptible to fatigue. Chronic androgen deprivation is associated with fatigue. That's one of the most prominent side effects.
Now, what was seen in both of the studies in terms of GI toxicity, nausea, and vomiting with chemotherapy and hair loss?
With weekly, there's very little hair loss. There is definitely hair loss. In fact, we were a little surprised because we found more than we thought. About 30% of patients had quite significant hair loss, almost complete alopecia. GI toxicity with the weekly schedule is almost unheard of. It's minimal. Occasional patients present this sort of unusual GI toxicity. It can be severe, but in general, it's no toxicity at all. So the spectrum of toxicity with weekly Taxotere was not bad at all. There are some data in RTOG trials with Taxol and some scattered data with every 3-week Taxotere in men with no metastatic disease. We treated, together with the group at Sloan Kettering, a group of men who had biochemical relapse, so they had very early disease. We treated them with an every 3-week schedule of Taxotere, along with hormonal therapy and sort of a rapid cycling. The reason I'm mentioning this is because we gave Taxotere every 3 weeks in a group of men that I would anticipate will be quite similar to the one that will be entering our clinical trial. And it's quite, one thing that was very impressive is, as I said, yes, it does cause side effects, but I can live through it. I can do my normal activities most of the time. And I missed some meetings for the lawyers and other businessmen, but in general, it's quite doable. I think it's less toxic than the general chemotherapy that one uses for breast cancer in women.
Yeah, it's, you know, you think about that, that's usually going to contain adriamycin or doxorubicin.
Right.
There was a trial recently comparing adriamycin and cyclophosphamide to docetaxel or Taxotere and cyclophosphamide, and it did seem like there was less toxicity in the docetaxel approach. Getting back to the pilot adjuvant study, so that's fascinating. You're saying the number of relapses that you actually observed was a lot less than you would have expected based on their risk characteristics.
So, you know, just to see, when we do a pilot in general, we actually have bad patients, the real bad ones. And to have an idea, on the pilot study, we did not request that patients to be eligible have a undetectable PSA following radical prostatectomy. So about half of the patients actually had measurable PSAs following radical prostatectomies. And the pathological staging was quite advanced in these patients, many with positive nodes, positive margins. And in that subset of patients, the predicted median time to PSA relapse was only 10 months. So you can just imagine what it is. So the observed time to PSA relapse was about almost 20 months in this group of patients. And we have some men who have not relapsed yet. So it's quite interesting, quite encouraging. But obviously, that observation needs to be taken with a grain of salt.
Not a randomized study and all that, but that is interesting. Now, do these men get androgen deprivation also?
No, just single-agent Taxotere. The question was, can they get 6 months of chemotherapy? The surgeons were concerned. The sponsor was concerned about it. We saw no increase in the surgical complications, even though, as I mentioned, some of them had quite advanced disease. So we saw no increase in urological problems.
I guess it's always a challenge to try to predict what you're going to see in the adjuvant setting based on what you see in the metastatic setting. Things don't always translate. Sometimes they're better or sometimes they're not as effective.
Right.
But this sounds pretty encouraging.
Well, the important issue is that adjuvant trials today will have to employ androgen deprivation. Remember, androgen deprivation for prostate cancer in man probably is one of the most effective palliative treatments for solid tumors. If you take 100 men who have metastatic disease, 75% of them will have responses, many of them dramatic. So it's more effective than chemotherapy for breast cancer in women, for metastatic breast cancer.
Although it's similar in that breast cancer, the most effective systemic treatment is endocrine therapy. I mean, certainly in an ER-positive patient, sure, there's no question that hormone therapy is the key there. But you're saying that adjuvant androgen deprivation in prostate cancer, in other words, treating with an undetectable PSA, is effective?
We don't know. At this point, we have small studies, as you know. The best contemporary study was the Messing study, the ECOG study, patients with positive nodes that showed that there is a prolongation in survival. And Ed shared these data with me. In fact, he presented again in the AUA last year, and it showed a persistent, very impressive prolongation in median time to progression and survival. But it's a small trial, and I think it needs to be done again in all patients with high risk following radical prostatectomy. The reason I was mentioning this, because as we design a trial, there's no way not to have. We have to include necessarily androgen deprivation.
So what is the trial that you'd like to do?
Well, the trial that we're doing is the trial that I like to do.
Oh, so can you talk about the trial that you're doing then?
The trial that we're doing, I think it's a fascinating trial. I think that it is a study in which men that present with high-risk features, the high-risk features are the usual one. We quantify them by using Mercator's nomogram. So patients who have no more than a 60% chance of remaining disease-free at 5 years, that is biochemical, most of them, they are eligible for this study. These are patients who have typically high Gleason score, higher than 8, positive seminal vesicles, positive margins, positive nodes, disease outside of the gland. These patients are randomized among all the usual eligibility criteria. They have to have an undetectable PSA following radical prostatectomy, and that is measured somewhere between 2 to 3 months following radical prostatectomy. And the patients are then eligible, and then they're randomized between initial treatment or observation. And the observation arm is then treated at the time of progression. And the treatment on both arms is either 18 months of hormonal therapy with leuprolide or 18 months of hormonal therapy with leuprolide plus Taxotere given for 6 cycles, now using the every 3-week schedule.
And the hormone...
No prednisone will be used.
And the hormone therapy and chemotherapy are started simultaneously?
Started simultaneously.
That's interesting, because in breast cancer, they delay the hormone therapy till after the chemotherapy.
Right. I have a comment about that. But the delayed arm on that study then is at the time of relapse. They're randomized between the same treatment arm. So it's early versus delayed treatment. It's a 2x2 factorial design. And we're looking at the effects of early versus delayed treatment. And we're looking at the contributions of chemotherapy to hormonal therapy.
What a great study.
It's a good study. The only complications is not a survival study. In prostate cancer, a survival study would require many, many, many years, and we couldn't find a sponsor to actually go and be committed to do a study with over 5,000 patients to address that question. The other important
question...
What's
the primary endpoint then?
The primary endpoint is progression.
Clinical progression?
Clinical and biochemical progression. There is a controversy on what the biochemical progression actually means on these men. But we actually published just recently in the Journal of Urology that the Hopkins data and showing that the time of PSA relapse and following radical prostatectomy is a very strong predictor of outcome, particularly prostate cancer-specific mortality. So I wouldn't be surprised if, in fact, this is a high-risk group of men, when they actually relapsed, that they relapsed with that potentially lethal phenotype. I think that these men really will relapse with disease and are more likely to kill them. So it is a clinically significant endpoint. The other problem with prostate cancer is once you relapse, there's no standard approach. So it's very difficult to control for post-progression treatment. And that would go all the way to the hormone refractory state. What kind of hormonal therapy do you use? What duration of hormonal therapy? Do you use combined therapy? Do you use intermittent therapy? When do you start chemotherapy? What kind of chemotherapy? There are a plethora of protocols going on, and these are likely to be used. So I think it's probably the best. The important thing that we're going to develop on this trial, we have a number of committees. We have a correlational science committee where we take a tissue bank, a serum bank, and we also have a very unique committee which is shared by Mike Catan, and which essentially will test these nomograms prospectively and see whether we can validate a methodology that can be used to substitute for survival. So that will be a critical development in prostate cancer clinical trials and early disease as we get into this.
You know, it's interesting doing CME work and cancer education and seeing the difference in different tumor types, prostate cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer, etc. You know, it kind of surprises me that adjuvant androgen deprivation is not used more in prostate cancer. I mean, you're saying you're going to look at PSA progression. I mean, you would assume it's definitely going to delay PSA progression, just used androgen deprivation.
Well, no question.
So it's kind of weird why everybody made the leap to say, well, okay, well, we can wait until PSA becomes detectable, which is typical standard practice now.
Well, in fact, that's an important question. Personally, I am not in favor of using hormonal therapy immediately. And I would say that probably in the United States, if you ask 10 urologists, radiation therapists, or urological oncologists, medical oncologists, I would venture to say that no more than 5 would definitely, from their heart, say that, hey, immediate hormonal therapy is going to make you live longer, maybe for a subset of patients. Let me give you an example. If you look at patients who have a biochemical relapse, and we actually published that for the first time in 1999, it's so-called POUND data, and then we published the survival data last year, and that was Steve Friedland's data. And essentially, what you're going to find is that a great subset, a majority of men who have a biochemical relapse, may not die of prostate cancer. They actually have a very slow, progressive, long doubling time, and may not die of disease. So hormonal therapy has only that much of a reach. It's a good therapy, but for someone who's going to have a 15-year survival, 13-year survival, that is something that I am not sure hormonal therapy is likely to change very much. Let me give you an example. We have just traditionally treated at Johns Hopkins men with delayed hormonal therapy. So from 1982 to about early 2000, about 2002, we collected several hundred men that were treated with radical prostatectomy. When they relapsed, they were followed, and when they developed bone metastasis, they were given hormonal therapy. This is the way the urologists at Johns Hopkins practice. And the interesting thing is if you look at the median survival in that subset of patients, it's about 13 years with delayed hormonal therapy. That median survival is quite comparable to the median survival that Ed Messing published with immediate hormonal therapy in patients with positive nodes. Now, I know they're different patients, but the concept sort of gives you a little bit of an idea here that the concept of deferred hormonal therapy may not necessarily be associated with a very short survival. You can still get very long survivals here. You will get no toxicity of therapy, and when you need it for palliation, you have it available.
Although, you know, to a person who's 60 years old, a 13-year life expectancy maybe isn't what they're looking for.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it needs to be tested. And our trial, TAX 3501, is a perfect opportunity to do that at this point.
When do you think you're going to start seeing some answers?
Well, we just started. We don't even have everybody on board here in the United States. We, our own institution, just had it active this week. So we're ready to go now.
So when are you projecting that you'll finish accrual, and when are you projecting you might see some answers?
We hope to finish the accrual in 2 years and hope to have some answers in about 6 to 7 years. We're counting now with probably 26 countries we already have 160 institutions throughout the world on board or ready to go. And that's about 60% of where we're going to go.
That's an exciting study.
Absolutely.
What about the issue of trials? You mentioned the study at Memorial, trials evaluating chemotherapy and PSA relapse.
Well, these trials are evolving. The group at Memorial piloted, and we enthusiastically supported that, in a subset of men with high-risk biochemical relapse in a short doubling time or early metastatic disease, a program where we treated men with rapid cycling with hormonal therapy and chemotherapy based on some biological observations, how best to do that kind of approach. And there was an enthusiastic acceptance from both patients and physicians as far as that is concerned. We accrued really well on this.
Was this the phase two?
That was a phase two trial. But the group at Memorial is in process of activating a randomized trial for patients at high risk biochemical relapse, comparing hormonal therapy with or without chemotherapy. I'm not exactly sure what the design of that trial will be. It is also a trial that was sponsored by drug industry because these trials are very difficult to get sponsored and funded by the National Cancer Institute today.
What about the patient who has hormone refractory disease but still has only PSA disease? Do you think that chemotherapy off protocol is a consideration there?
Yeah, absolutely. That was a great question that we missed the opportunity to answer. There was a study, ECOG 1899. I remember in 1999, I went to ECOG and I proposed this study in which men who, it was quite obvious that this patient population, the androgen-independent, non-metastatic group of patients was going to evolve. They get treated with hormonal therapy early and they will relapse early with a rising PSA only. And that's, in fact, what's happening. So the question was, what should we do with these patients? The standard approach out in the community today is second line and third line sequential hormonal therapies.
And even a lot of times when patients get through second and third line, they still have PSA only disease.
And they still have PSA, and they stay with it, and they still have it for many years. And in fact, that's what the data showed. But some men have a poor outcome in this group. And here will be a great opportunity to evaluate chemotherapy. ECOG 1899 asked that question. We had to stop accrual. This is a difficult study to do. We compared two different modalities of treatment. But it was a necessary study, and we were very disappointed. It was a study ahead of its time. We hope to come back and address that question again sometime in the future.
I mean, do we know what happens if you give docetaxel to 100 men who have PSA-only disease, and there's a what fraction go down?
We don't know. And that study, 1899, was chaired by Mike Carducci in our institution, and Mike made an enormous effort to get that study disseminated along with the NCI and the ECOG members. But we don't know. And some patients who present with a very short doubling time, 3 months or less, in that subset, these men will develop metastatic disease less than a year.
So you have a man like that, will you consider using chemotherapy?
Absolutely. If it's a young man who's motivated, I would definitely consider doing that. But I prefer not to. I would prefer, obviously, having a clinical trial addressed in that fashion.
Have you seen patients like that who had obvious and significant drops in PSA just from chemotherapy?
Sure. Oh, yeah. Including men who have a biochemical relapse only treated with chemotherapy. There are studies that show that, indeed, the response to chemotherapy alone without androgen deprivation is higher than 50%.
Any sort of global feeling as you look at prostate cancer in terms of what the sensitivity is to chemotherapy, specifically docetaxel, since it seems to be, you know, kind of so encouraging at this point compared to other solid tumors? I think maybe people have had this concept that it's sort of chemo resistant. Do you think that's true?
It's not, no. I remember in 1985, in the pre-PSA era, I wrote a paper about chemotherapy for hormone refractory prostate cancer, and the endpoint was survival. It was dismal, responses were low. Why is it that we see it differently now? I think one of the main reasons is that we see a different man now with prostate cancer than we used to before. The PSA provided us this enormous lead time effect here. So there's a major stage migration. And along with that, along with a better general condition of the host, of the patient with metastatic prostate cancer. We see that we're dealing with the diseases a lot more biologically different, including in terms of its susceptibility to chemotherapy. I think prostate cancer patients are as sensitive to chemotherapy as in other solid tumors that are considered responsive to it.
What's on the horizon in terms of systemic therapy of prostate cancer? What are some of the new strategies and treatments that are being looked at that you think are going to yield results in the next few years?
I am very enthusiastic about bone-targeted approaches. I mean, the relationship between prostate cancer and bone metastasis is known for many years, and it's quite intriguing. Biologically, it's quite interesting. It's fascinating. I would say that a combined bone-targeted approach with systemic chemotherapy is probably, in my opinion, if explored vigorously the way I think it should, would be the next standard treatment for prostate cancer. For instance, bisphosphonates show a very modest but definitely effect. It's only about 11% reduction on skeletal-related events over time with some reduction. These modest benefits, one can look at it from the skeptical point of view in that way, or with the optimistic eye, the way I looked at it, it is a benefit. It is a step in the right direction.
When you say skeletal events, do you mean metastases?
Well, issues related to bone metastasis, pain, need for radiation therapy, pathological fractures, instances of epidural cord compression. And here, that is reduced over time with the administration of bisphosphonates. Then we go over radiopharmaceuticals. The data with radiopharmaceuticals is fascinating. We can explore several things. First is a targeted treatment approach with bone-seeking radiopharmaceuticals like samarium quadramat or similar compounds that are currently being developed is quite interesting. In addition to the bone-targeted approach, you can explore a synergism between chemotherapy and radiation therapy. We're doing a phase 1 trial and others as well, in which we give taxanes on day 1 followed by samarium on day 2. And that is very interesting because if you give taxanes, you create that block and a accumulation of cells in the G2M cycle, and these cells are extremely susceptible to the radiation effect. And so the day 1 taxane followed by samarium, we're doing this concomitantly up front to every man with hormone refractory prostate cancer with bone metastasis. Then we see other interesting approaches. The monoclonal antibody against the RANK ligand, denosumab by Amgen, it's a fascinating compound. It really almost completely abrogates osteoclastic function. And you know, osteoclasts are very important in the process of metastatic disease, including prostate cancer. The RANK ligand pathway is overexpressed in metastatic prostate cancer to the bone as well. The inactive osteoclast is associated with a overexpression of cytokines, which are so important in the pathogenesis of any disease.
And where do you think these bone-targeted approaches would have the greatest effect? Do you see them being used, for example, in the adjuvant setting or PSA-only setting or just in metastatic disease?
I think they need to be proven first in a metastatic setting. And then I think today, for instance, if you look at a man who has a rising PSA and a doubling time of 3 months or less, that man has a median survival which is quite similar to the one who has stage D2 disease. So he has a significant tumor burden. It is subclinical, but very close to the threshold where you're going to see it on the bone scan. I think this man with a rising PSA and a very short PSA doubling time is the stage D2 patients of the PSA era.
That's fascinating. Do you think, I was just talking to Steve Friedland about this, I'm curious what your take is in terms of what's going on in the community setting, urologists, radiation oncologists, in terms of their sensitivity to the issue of PSA doubling time, not just, you know, sort of generally knowing that it's a factor, but specifically, are there patients who really ought to be jumped on who aren't being jumped on?
Well, I think that concept is only now being disseminated in the community. until very recently, every man with a rising PSA was either considered for therapy or not, depending on whether you believe it or not. Now we're beginning to see that some men, I think the community physicians, are beginning to accept the fact that not everybody requires therapy, that the outcome is quite different, and that the PSA doubling time is an important factor that defines the outcome on these patients. I think that one is becoming more and more aware of the patient who relapses with a very short PSA doubling time. And the fascinating thing, in my experience, at least in the Maryland area, is that instead of just simply giving these men hormones, they are frequently sent to centers that really focus on clinical trials.
Interesting.
To get these patients into some sort of clinical trial.
You know, I kind of wonder whether when you have a patient whose absolute PSA level is actually very low, but yet their doubling time is very fast, maybe that's a situation where people maybe aren't quite as aware of it? Or
oh, absolutely.
Think?
The physician should be aware. If you look at the Hopkins data that Steve Friedland reported last year, if you consider that a man who has a PSA relapse has it when the PSA is 0.2 or higher and rising, and that's the Hopkins data, that man, if he has a PSA doubling time of 3 months or less, survival measured from the time that he has a relapse is about 6.5 years. That is the same median survival that we see today in men with stage D2 disease with the stage migration with that lead effect. That's about 6 years. So that patient, you can calculate and you can establish the PSA doubling time with two or three, preferably three PSAs. So someone may have a defined PSA doubling time with a PSA, let's say, or less than two. And the clock is ticking in that patient. And it's ticking from the time that the PSA is 0.2 rising, and the survival is only last 6 years.
We're starting to see some interesting things in anti-angiogenic strategies with breast cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer, now renal cell cancer, a lot of exciting things with the TKIs. What about the anti-angiogenic strategy with prostate cancer?
Well, it is interesting. In prostate cancer, there are a number of, particularly the study with Avastin, bevacizumab study done by CALGB, show that the existing data with bevacizumab as a single agent in hormone refractory prostate cancer is difficult to evaluate because, like in any other disease, we don't see actual responses, and that's what we see in prostate cancer. But what was intriguing is that in a phase 2 trial done by CALGB, a combination of Taxotere and bevacizumab was associated with very high response rates, about close to 80%. High 70s PSA responses. And when you go out 12 months or even longer than that, a substantial proportion of these patients still remained in responses. Now, obviously, one needs to be very cautious about that because of the heterogeneity of patients with hormone refractory disease and the fact that this is not a randomized trial.
Although,
but
I mean,
it's very interesting.
But and that's exactly what's been seen in the other solid tumors. Not
right.
much effect by itself,
right.
somehow seeming to potentiate chemotherapy.
No, the most intriguing data in my point of view is early disease. And I think that it's a lot more interesting than the hormone refractory state. And I think that if we look at various tissue parameters of angiogenesis, they all have a predictive outcome for biochemical relapse, just about all of them, in different studies done in different institutions. So I think the place to test it would be in the post-prostatectomy patient. What we really favor is what we did with Taxotere. Look at that window between the surgery and the biochemical relapse,
right.
and see whether you can prolong that. You may not have to do it in a pilot study, but maybe the way Dr. Montgomery is doing in a VA study, by randomizing against no treatment and seeing whether that prolongs time to PSA relapse. It's a great window to evaluate.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what's happening in all the other tumors. You know, unfortunately, they've already demonstrated that chemotherapy works in the adjuvant setting. We're just starting to look at that in prostate cancer, but soon trials like your study in 6 or 7 years show benefit from chemotherapy. You might think another logical step would be then adding in something like bevacizumab to the chemotherapy.
Absolutely. We are going to evaluate a number of tissue markers and look at their prognostic value in terms of biochemical relapse and other relapse. We hope to be able to come up with a lot of important preclinical data that can be translated in the future.
You know, the whole strategy for doing large randomized studies to look at things like, you know, adjuvant therapy has clearly been set out now for many, many years. And it is unfortunate that prostate cancer is so far behind. One of the things I wonder about, and I'm curious what your thoughts are, is that I see, at least until recently, the medical oncologists not as integrated into the care of these patients as they are with, you know, the other solid tumors. And I wonder whether that's part of the reason that we don't have the clinical research we need.
I think so. When we talk about clinical research with new compounds, that's the field of the medical oncologist involved, and that's behind in prostate cancer. The area of radiation, radiopharmaceuticals, surgery, it's fairly well developed. I think even in the urology field today, we see that the new generation of urologists is actually fascinating. Their understanding about basic tumor biology is fascinating, is quite interesting. They go to the molecular basis. And I was hoping that one of these urologists will become the burner fish in oncology and develop something that we really need to end urological oncology.
Yeah, it's interesting, that concept of Bernie Fisher. And, you know, the flip side of Bernie Fisher were the surgeons who, I guess, had the opposite strategy in terms of using local therapy to control the disease.
Right. I think we're now only now dealing with the fact that the old Haustedian concept of local disease metastasizing, maximizing local control, is not the right way to understand prostate cancer. It is a systemic disease frequently, like many others, with a long natural history, of course.
All right. What are some of the other clinical research strategies in prostate cancer right now that you think are going to have an impact on clinical practice in the near future?
The one area that intrigues me is the androgen receptor as a target. You know, the androgen receptor remains functional, triggering till the very end, even in situations where we actually consider the patients as having hormone refractory disease. It still has a function, not through the hormonal mechanism, but fundamentally the same way. It's activated by different cytokines or different mechanisms.
So it's still there. Not
hormone, but still there. And the interesting thing is that there are some preclinical data that suggest that you're able to neutralize the androgen receptor. You almost completely abrogate tumor growth. So I think if we actually develop a compound that is able to target the androgen receptor, we're probably going to accomplish quite a bit, and that can be used very early.
It's interesting because there is an agent like that in breast cancer, fulvestrin or Faslodex, that basically destroys the estrogen receptor. Unfortunately, it doesn't cure women with breast cancer. Is there anything like that in prostate
cancer?
No,
not at this point. We have some compounds that focus on chaperone proteins, cytoplasmatic proteins, but we don't know whether they actually are specific to the androgen receptor. There's some other compounds that bind to the androgen receptor, but they really don't neutralize it the way we would like to.
Another major trend in solid tumor oncology is trying to come up with better tissue predictors of prognosis as well as response to therapy. We started now, actually, in breast cancer, you know, you have a genomic analysis, the Oncotype DX assay, that's used every day right now to determine the care of patients in this country. Where are we in similar strategies for prostate cancer?
We are hoping that the current generation of clinical trials would allow us to store tissue and develop that. In fact, the spores in prostate cancer, like in the other diseases as well, have a common storage of tissue system mechanism, and that will perhaps allow the investigators involved in this sport to sort of look into markers of all kinds for translating in the future and targeted therapy, prognostic factors, etc. But we're not nearly where other diseases are, unfortunately.